Mr. Maven Rail 10. So you arrived in Hong Kong.
We arrived on the cruise ship, obviously, and it was night time. I remember it was night time when we got there. And the thing that struck everybody was the amount of lights that were all around the place. The boat seemed to be sailing into a mass of lights.
Right.
And up ahead there was red lights. Obviously, they were on the top of the mountains because Kai Tak Airport, you find this afterwards, Kai Tak Airport is Hong Kong, and they've got it's the north of one to get into. And so it's like all our television masts have got lights up on the top. I think that's what they thought. But all we could see was this massive lights, and then these red lights going around. Then the boat tied up, and we stayed on the boat. And then the next morning, we were tied up to a quay, and everybody was disembarking. And I was thinking of that. We were known as the DLI draft. Not Somos Salamanca went when we left Bransford. On the boat, we were the DLI draft. You know, there was the Chief of Commerce draft or whatever. And so we got off the boat, and we had a short march with our kit bags and everything to the station, railway station. Because we docked at Kowloon, which is the mainland, and it's part of the new territory. It's known as the new territory. Hong Kong is Northern Ireland, but the cruise ships are not calling the Kowloon,
which is part of the mainland.
Yeah, it's like the port part of the mainland, and where you get the staff from Kowloon to Hong Kong. We're off the board. And it was just a short march to the railway station. And I can't even remember whether it was a troop train. I don't think it was. It was a Tote Kai was reserved on the train.
Was this everybody off the board?
Just the DLI.
Just the DLI draft.
Because there was garrisons in Kowloon and Hong Kong, and the Air Force lads would be going to the RAF place.
So you were split up in different parts of
to wherever you wanted to do, whatever, you know. And we got on the train, and it wasn't a long journey, maybe it was an hour and a half. And it went up to a village called Phan Minh. That was the station where we got off the train. But the line carries on, because after Phan Minh was the customs and the Chinese border. And the train, I don't know whether the change, but you couldn't get the train all the way up into Canton. You know, it was the line through, it was a continuous line.
So how far was Phan Minh out of the city itself?
About an hour and a half on the train. And that was about, I think I know it was about the farthest one away from Hong Kong. Anyway, so we got off the Phan Minh, and there was a man walking through them for us. And then it took us down this valley. It was a wide valley, hills and mountains. And the valley was cultivated in paddy fields. And that. And as we got a couple of miles down this road, we came across all these football pitches and rugby pitches and that one. Then on the left hand side, on this hill, it was all large army cap badges. They called it Cap Badge Hill. And each regiment or battalion who had been stationed there, a bit like the White Horse of so and so, you know what they are. And they'd put the badge in stone on the hill. On the hillside.
Oh, they placed stone into the cap badge shape?
Yeah, obviously it wasn't a DLI one, because the DLI weren't there, but there was look on the cap badges, you know. And then, of course, we got so far down, and we turned off, and we were taken to the Royal Worcester Rifle camp. That's who we were stationed with. And we got off the bus, off the wagons, and they put us in some huts. And then that was it. We were then under the auspices of the Royal Ulster Rifles. The reason being that they had just come out of Korea, and so that everybody felt that they would pass on to us what they had learned, the type of terrain it was, and all the rest. And so we had, I know I had Christmas in Hong Kong with the Ulster Rifles. Would have been a Catholic regiment that had a priest. The British regiments have a vicar. And I was Catholic, so obviously I was only looking at that mass. Whereas if you were the British battalion, you were out. Yeah. And,
can you describe this camp?
Well, it was built on the side of the hill. I'm not sure there was a few little things. And there were decent huts. So
what were they made out of?
I think they might have been brick. But we had 20 blocks or more in a hut. There were double beds, bottom and top.
Bunks.
Double bunks. And we had the first time I encountered the mosquito nets. We had to have a mosquito net on. And it was up a height, so we've got to go down steps onto the road. And the other huts were round about. And then the cookhouse was somewhere else away. And the canteen was somewhere else. And it was obviously split up into companies because the Ulster Rifles, I don't know what their companies are called, but we were a company. And we came under, we had sergeants and officers and the Ulster Rifles people. And
so you split into a sort of company strength with someone from the Ulster Rifles?
We were company, the Ulster Rifles. And we had Ulster Rifle corporals and sergeants and officers.
What was the accommodation like then? What did you think of it?
It was all right. The accommodation was cunning. The food was cunning.
Were all the Durhams together in a block?
We were all together. Maybe we'll take up two blocks, you know. And, it was cunning.
Was it comfortable?
Yeah. No complaints would have come.
How were you received at the camp then with the Royal Ulster?
No problem. Just accepted it. I don't know if I felt sorry for because I'm going there, they just left.
Just before I come on to that, because that's quite interesting, what was the sanitation like in that camp?
Well, there were dry mittens. Actually, from leaving this country, we never had any flush toilets till we got back. it was a hut with maybe six holes. A wood base with six holes in, and you just point yourself down there, and underneath each hole was a bucket. And then each day that bucket was changed, the Chinese used to come and take it. And there used to be wandering through the camp with those yokes on with two buckets on shit. You could smell them before they came. And that's why they always used to say if you're buying fruit, they always peel it because they're that beautiful anyway. And so you've got to be careful what fruit you buy abroad because of the manure that they put on that. Yeah. But that was the sanitation. It was like that. We had cold water. It was cold water, like an ablution, with lots of taps and that, and galvanized bushes. You could fill the tap.
So how many men would this little block of ablutions with the six places, how many men would that serve?
Well, it was never full. There was always a spare. There might have been six at this side and six at the other, and it was never full. It was only once that when it wasn't in Hong Kong, it was when we were in Egypt, when it was full, when half the camp went down with dysentery, and you went and it was full of, and you were running around, but it was adequate. You didn't have a queue, it was more or less adequate, and so the food was coming. And then, but when we got there, our training was, we did very little marching or rifle training, because I'm not sure, but I think our the light infantry drill is different to the Ulster Rifles drill. We marched quicker, I think. We were supposed to do some of their guards, but I can't remember anybody doing any. They tried to get us to, you see, they'd come out of Korea and they were like on the peacetime portion. And the bottom of your bayonet scabbard, I mean, they were all black. And they'd scrape the bottom inch of the scabbard, they'd scrape all the black, I don't know what it was, stuff that was there, and they were polished like silver. And they weren't enough to do it. And somebody came and says, no, they can't do that, they're going into Korea, and they can't have any bright. And so we were excused doing this pulling up that they did. It was just something that they did.
Was that something unique to the Ulsters?
No. You know, I mean, you know, you get it behind the scabbard, and it's all matte black, for want of a better word, I don't know what it would, and the bottom would scrape it off. And obviously it was, I don't know, steel or something, and they had it really bold. Right. It was just for these stick guards. You know what a stick guard is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're detailed to go on guard, you've got to have your vestments pulled up, your uniform pressed, your being with your rifle, your hair cut, you know, everything. And the officer obviously inspects you. And the person who is the best dressed, for want of a better word, smartest, he's excused doing the guard duty and the call, what he calls the stick. But he then accompanies the CEO wherever he goes for that day. And then at the end of the week, the six people who have been picked for the six guard, they have the one to pick one for that, you know. And so all these little things to try and be smart and, you know, the process of all the issues and all the rest of I never saw it, but I heard that the officer couldn't make his mind up between them. It means a lot to get this stick, like, you know, he couldn't make his mind up between two. I go and threaten him, he said, wait, take your boots off. And he had looked to see if anybody had holes in his socks, or if it had a hole in it, darned it. You know, it goes down to, I've never saw it mine, but I've heard it, but that's the type of thing that...
So it was an incentive, really.
Incentive, you know. But fortunately, I think we were expected... I think
so did you do any guard duties?
Not with North of Rifles. We did a lot of training. Once more, it was training. We went up and down mountains. And every Saturday, everybody had to do a cross-country run. The CEO, he decreed that everybody had to do this 5 or 6 mile cross-country run. It was along the top of paddy fields, you know, all over. And if you were on guard or doing duties on Saturday morning, you had to do it on Sunday. So there's no way, unless you're on the sick or something like that, there's no way you could miss these cross-country runs. And it was all for fitness, to get you fit, right, to keep your own men fit.
So what was the daily routine then at this camp? What time was Reveille?
Well, Reveille would be about 6 o'clock, and breakfast.
Can you remember what sort of things you got for breakfast?
Well, it would be the same as what we had in the UK, porridge, or even though it was hot, and cornflakes, right? Bacon and egg, the usual stuff, bread, maybe, I don't know, we had any toast, fried bread, we always had fried bread. And then we used to come away from there and come back to the hut. And then everybody had to parade. Now, I can't remember whether we were allowed to take a couple of waterways, because then, on parade, the officer came along with the sergeant, and you had your hand out, and you got a salt tablet, and a paladin tablet, and another tablet for malaria and for the salt loss and the sweat. And you had to take them while you was there. Now, I can't remember if they were allowed to take a cup of water there, swallow them down, or whether they just had to go down. So he stood until he saw you take them.
Was it still the same sort of kit inspections?
No. Not for us. Because we were moving on. Yes, we lost the rifle lads. Yes, you know. But our kit had gone from the khaki Blanco kit to, I said, the jungle green type of kit. And there was no brasses to polish. It was all dark and everything was dull. So that we couldn't really make it pull it up. They keep turning, but not pull it up. And then we had a chance for a bit of sport, as they had all these football pitches and that, you know, maybe go down and have a game of football. And I had a miniature assault course, we all know, jump over trenches and this and that. There's one of the lads hurt his ankle or his foot. And that was the last time we saw him until, Egypt. And he got a pin in his foot, and of course that meant he was all so far behind. And just went down to hospital in Hong Kong, and that was it. But and then we'll go and do these exercises, platoon exercises, walking along the way, just on the shoulder, started flashing on the roads, and then there was one night we got called out. Supposedly there was an invasion, and the whole lot had to mobilise and go to pre-arranged positions. And they reckoned it was the route to China. The Japanese came in when they came in from, you know, during the Second World War. That was how it came down. These positions had been prepared. And then, you know, the next morning, we just went back to camp again. You know, just seeing how fit or how quick they got to these positions. And then,
what other kinds of things were you doing there?
Well, we went up on the border to do a border patrol on the Chinese border. That was a bit a sight. It was a bit eye-opening. The fighters in the wagons, all our gear on, took us down the continuation of the Royal Service Valley to where you couldn't go any further, and we all got out of the wagons. There was all this gear lying on the side of the road. I hope we don't have to carry all this lot. Anyway, around the hill comes the mule train. There was all these mules, and they lifted all the gear onto the pack mules.
What sort of gear are we talking about?
Well, medical supplies, ammunition, and food, water, and everything. And it was part of the Royal Army Service Corps, RAMC. The other ones were the transport people, and there was English officer, English sergeant possibly, but like the mule tickets, if you want to call them, were Chinese, and that all they, and then we set off along the valley bottom, and then just put in mind of the old kind of the past days when the head of the column was nearly at the top of the hill and the bottom just winding its way around. And there, but I go up into the hills, and there's a lot of villages up in the hills. And part of it, apart from showing that we were there, and we hadn't forgotten about these people, I don't know whether they were frightened of gun running, drug running, or communists, because of China, but we were there showing the flag. And the medical people who were with us used to go into the village with the officer. Asked the head man if I had any illness, sickness, and sort of parade with sleeping in the room, and the medical people did what was necessary, you know, stuck a rasta plaster on it.
Was this your first contact with the natives?
Aye. And, well, the same.
Well, I was going to ask you what your impressions were.
Well, the same sort of. They didn't seem pleased to see us. Even though we're offering them first aid. And then...
Can you just describe the villages? What were they like?
Well...
What were the living conditions like of the people?
Mud huts and very, very primitive. I was going to say later on. That was up in the hills. And then there was another time, we camped rough. We slept rough.
So how long did that last?
Just about a week. And another time we came down out of the hills and came down onto the like I said, it wasn't the same, it was the inlet or something. And we came to sort of village, did the same, and then we stayed the night at this village. I think we slept around the temple or something. But anyway, come dark, this is when I first saw it. In went the hens, in went the goat, in went the cow, and everything went into the house, and they all slept together. And that's, you know, my God, what's this like, you know? And everything that they owned went into the house room. And we slept outside, I think. And then the next morning they would open up and they were coming galloping out again. And that was, everything that they had was locked up at night.
So how big were these houses?
Well, they weren't very big. I think they must have all slept together. You know, I don't know. We never actually went in, you know, in fancy really. They had some temples. They had a temple there, and they were allowed to use some facilities in the temple for boiling water and lit a fire underneath it and something to boil some water with. But very, very primitive, very, you know, stony age sort of, as far as we're concerned. And would have been on the shore, and it was a bit of a fishing village as well. And had these old little boats that went out. Instead of a light on the end, and a light that was to attract the fish or something, and throw a net out and catch it. You know, it was very educational if you were that way inclined. And we came climbing up these mountains and that, and you got a lot of lovely scenic views. You know, you just come around the mountain, and then you see the deer and all the jinks and all the little sandpans and that, just like a painting and putting, you know, things that you'd only see on the cinema, right? So it's like, there it was, everything was there. And this patrol that we're on, so went up and down, up and down. And I know there was once we were at the bottom of this mountain, and there was a big waterfall coming down. And I said, right, fill your water bottles, because we had tablets for
purification
tablets. And while we were there, there was a little old woman come by, and she was laying down the youth and she passed us, you know, all the bottom. And we never saw a sight, and we were, she had about 10 minutes start on us. And we were nowhere off this bloody mountain, so we went up, down the other side, and across at the bottom, and we nowhere to catch up with her, I'll say. It was a bit farcical, going up, supposed to be trying to catch them smuggling out there, then they could see us a day before we got there. But that was the patrols that I only did one. Obviously, I wasn't there long enough to do anymore.
So that was up on the border. Did you actually, was there a physical border?
Well, we never saw it. I think there was permanent guards, maybe used to rifles or another battalion was actually manned it with binoculars. But all right, there was a border.
I just wondered if there was a fence.
There was a fence. Yeah.
Did you actually get up to it? Or?
No, we just sort of where we were, could see where that's coming as China. You know, where you can have a look down and see the moon, but we weren't, didn't look into the fence. Now, you know.
So you never actually came close up to the Chinese?
Not close up to them, no. And see, that was it.
And you were under canvas for a week?
Well, I've explained how we clipped the ponchos together and that. And then another time, another time we did some, what they used to call them, schemes, I don't know what to call them now, you know, we used to go out and get fictitious attacks and that, you know, and then have the down things and that.
Was this as the Durhams? Was it in the unit
and
with the Ulster Rifles as well?
Yeah. And I liked Hong Kong. If I didn't want to stay there, I might have signed on. It was a good postman. Because if you didn't have any duties on the weekend, you couldn't really get a Monday to Friday job. And if it comes Saturday after the cross country run and everybody's sorted out, if you hadn't got any duties to do, guards or you'd all right, you could go and get the train from Fan Lane down to Kowloon, could get the staff ready across to Hong Kong, and you could go to the I'm not sure if it was a Chinese fake club or the soldiers and sailors. You could get a bed and breakfast for half crown, which was 2 and 6.
So you were allowed to stop overnight?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll just come on to that in a second, because I just wanted, you mentioned these schemes. How many of them did you do when you were up there?
Well, we did about 2 or 3.
And what sort of things do they consist of? Can you?
Well, you go out and you say, right, or you march in, as I say, staggered style up the road, you know, march way around. Then you say, right, are we going to do a company attack up this ridge or so, you know, and then you have to do these, you know, and get down and suppose you fire and go up, you know, and then they would say, okay, the RAF are coming in on it, all aircraft are enemy, you know. And so then they would come down, and if you were on the top of the hill, or you just logged over the top.
Was the actual RF taking part?
You're actually, well, you just logged over the top, so you're in the dead, you know, into them that way. And then half an hour later, you come back to it, logged over the other side. And then, or if you were walking along, and they came down, you had to disperse. And they were the type of thing, and then you were sleeping out, you know, sleeping rough.
Was there any trench digging or anything
about that? Just shallow. It's all pretty rock hard, isn't it? You couldn't really dig in the trenches. It was rock hard. And then we would go down and we were somewhere near Kaita Airport, which is the RAF place, and saw how the RAF lads, how easy they had it. And we were all flogging about here, and then the RAF was lying back, taking it easy. And then, as I say, we get back to camp, and can we get up in the boots and everything. And on a night, you could go down to the Maffey. There was a Maffey there, where you could go and buy a beer, if you wanted, or buy a meal. Or you could go down into Fan Lin, which is a village, and there was a village dancer on, and the village girls and that were there.
You mentioned before, you said the Ulsters had already been to Korea,
yeah.
And I guess these schemes were kind of training for Korea.
For us to go on, yeah.
And you did these with the Ulsters.
Aye, yeah.
Was there any formal instruction? Were they telling you what Korea was like? The kind of things you were to expect?
Not really. Not really. They say, well, you know, but you see, the thing about it was, when the youngsters were there, they were running up and down the country. You know, the Korean War was in 2 stages. The first half of the war was a mobile war. Seoul itself changed hands 4 times. And that was when the Ulsters were there. They were there when the Gloucesters were there, and the Northumberland Fusiliers. And they were sort of up and down. So all this movement of attacking a hill was what they'd done. But you see, when we got there, it was a static war. We were fighting from the trenches, which the Ulsters hadn't done. So they told us what the terrain was like and everything, you know. But they kept, you know, they told you what they were. They didn't talk about it much, you know.
So they didn't tell you what their experiences, what had happened?
No, not much, no.
Was there much fraternising between the two regiments?
The Ulsters. Oh, no, there was no problem. The only thing we thought of follow them, we said to them, oh, you were there when the Gloucesters were there. You know, because the Gloucesters came out with a lot of glory about this stand which they did. And they were awarded to wear 2 back caps, 2 badges, because they were supposed to stand back to back and all the rest. Don't mention the Gloucesters to us, and that was that. they have a bit of it's you know, those Gloucesters weren't very well liked by the Ulsters, for one thing or another. But apart from that, no problem. As I say, we had a corporal who slept in the same bed as us, and you know, said, all I can remember what he said was, for about 3 days he just ran when we were being pushed back. He just ran. It was in the summer. He had a bandolier of 50 rounds around his shoulders, a bit like a bandit. on the rifle, and as you would stop and lose a few shots off them, and then run my head back into something, got stabilised, trying to find the unit, because everything was a bit chaotic. And he said, you know, just that was it. They didn't really tell you all that much, not many casualties.
Had they suffered many casualties, you know?
Yeah. They suffered more than the Gloucesters. The North Umbrians, I think, suffered more than the Gloucesters.